this is such a special opportunity to present such a wide kaleidoscopic set of events within a short span of time that I think it's worth it. I think of it a little bit like a museum. You might stop and linger in front of one painting that captures your fancy, or you might just walk through, but it does enter your consciousness. And so the ability to be around all these pieces together, I'm sure that it gives something to people that is special.
Und damit danke fürs Einschalten und herzlich willkommen beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Mein Name ist Julika.
Ich bin Tom.
Lieber Tom, du hast für diese Folge mit dem amerikanischen Dirigenten Alan Gilbert gesprochen. Alan Gilbert ist seit 2019 Chefdirigent beim NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchester, gehört also im Haus hier eigentlich im Prinzip schon zum Inventar. Ist völlig überfällig, dass ihr mal gesprochen habt, aber in diesem Fall gab es sogar einen besonderen Anlass, weil unser neues Musikfestival Elbphilharmonie Visions vor der Tür steht.
Genau, das war der eine und einzige Anlass, ganz ungewöhnlich beim Talk. Wir haben wirklich ganz monothematisch einfach dieses Feld beackert, was einfach so spannend ist und wo er auch so viel Leidenschaft dahinter hat und das einfach ihm so sehr am Herzen liegt, dass diese neueste der neuen Musik irgendwie Gehör findet, dass die aufgeführt wird, dass die gut geprobt aufgeführt wird, dass die in diesem Saal aufgeführt wird, der
mit Top-Rundfunkorchestern.
Nur mit Top-Rundfunkorchestern und der Saal, der danach schreit, dass da neue Musik stattfindet. Und
dazu muss man sagen, in der Musikwelt bezeichnet man als neue Musik eigentlich inzwischen ziemlich viel. Teilweise ist das Musik, die inzwischen 100 Jahre alt ist. In diesem Fall meinen wir aber wirklich neue Musik, also ausschließlich 21. Jahrhundert.
Genau, nur Kompositionen für Orchester aus dem 21. Jahrhundert. Und zwar oft auch für großes Orchester, oft auch noch Chor dabei oder Stimme. Also wirklich das große Besteck sozusagen. Und das ist ein, finde ich, für Leute, die sich für neue Musik ein bisschen erwärmen und begeistern können, ist das ein Luxus. So ein Riesenluxus, dann in dieser Stadt wohnen zu dürfen, wo man 7 Konzerte an 2 verlängerten Wochenenden mit, glaube ich, 15 Stücken oder noch mehr wirklich taufrische Ware zu hören bekommt. Man hat ein anderes Gefühl von Zeitgenossenschaft, glaube ich, wenn man da rausgeht.
Ja, und das ist ja etwas, was in anderen Disziplinen, also in der bildenden Kunst oder so, viel etablierter ist, dass man, wenn es etwas Neues gibt, sich dafür interessiert. Und ich habe das Gefühl, in der Musik gibt es noch ganz andere Berührungsängste.
Genau, das ist das Riesendilemma, da haben wir auch länger darüber gesprochen, dass Herr Allen auch sagt, er kennt so viele Leute, die wahnsinnig intellektuell sind und unheimlich klug und auch ganz offen für Kunst überhaupt und bildende Kunst in jede neue Ausstellung gehen und da immer was irgendwie auch vielleicht Kontroverses dazu empfinden oder mitzuteilen haben. Aber bei der neuen Musik, da strecken sie die Waffen und sagen, lass mich damit in Frieden, das ist nichts für mich. Also alles andere gerne, aber Musik bitte dann doch Mozart, Schumann, Wagner, à la rigueur noch Stravinsky, aber danach doch bitte. Und das ist seltsam. Und er hat lange darüber nachgedacht, warum ist das so? Wie kann es sein, dass in dem Geist von so vielen tollen Leuten da so eine Fehlstelle ist? Und dann kam er mit dem naheliegenden, aber doch irgendwie auch bedenkenswerten Befund, es liegt an der Zeit. Und zwar nicht an der Zeit, in der wir gerade leben, sondern an dem Umstand, dass du
für Musik Zeit brauchst.
Du brauchst die Zeit, die das blöde Stück dauert. Du kannst da nicht irgendwie verständnisähnlich blickend an diesem unverständlichen Kunstwerk vorbeigehen und sagen, interessant.
Ich gucke mir das nicht an.
Du bist gefesselt, sitzt im Saal und musst dir das geben. Und das ist natürlich schwer. Und dann sind es nur Klänge und nur Musik, die du noch nicht kennst, die auf dich einströmen und die du sortieren musst. Und der Kopf ist sehr beteiligt. Der ist ja auch in anderen Künsten sehr beteiligt und so. Und das ganze ästhetische System,
das ganze Fühlen ist beteiligt.
Und da ist so viel, was man in dieser Echtzeit sortieren muss. Und das ist eine Menge. Also das muss man schon zugestehen.
Wobei viele da ja eigentlich eher eine positive Erfahrung machen. Also ich erinnere das von vor 2 Jahren bei der ersten Ausgabe von Elbphilharmonie Visions, dass eigentlich auch viele Leute, die vielleicht sogar das erste Mal im Haus waren, danach das Gefühl hatten, das hat wirklich was gemacht. Und sie haben da was erlebt und es war irgendwie mitreißend. Es sind ja auch eher kompakte Konzerte, ohne Pause überwiegend. Sogar noch, um so ein bisschen auch Einblicke zu geben mit kurzen KünstlerInnen-Gesprächen auf der Bühne. Und ich glaube, das hat doch viele Leute dann abgeholt.
Ja, total, weil man dann eben, man lernt die Komponistinnen, die Komponisten auch kennen. Selbst wenn das kurze Gespräche sind, die waren irgendwie sehr instruktiv, fand ich. Und da kriegt man ja ganz viel mit, auch wie jemand arbeitet, wie jemand spricht über ihre Arbeit. Das gibt einem so ein menschliches Gefühl. Und dann hat man eher vielleicht auch die Bereitschaft, auch was Komplexes sich einfach anzuhören, weil man sagt, das hat's verdient. Der Mensch ist gekommen, der präsentiert sein Werk, der ist auch nur ein verletzlicher Mensch, der jetzt darauf wartet, dass wir das anhören und wie wir das finden werden. Und natürlich ist es in aller Regel so, dass sie dann schon sehr beeindruckt sind davon. Das ist eh mein Mantra, dass, also, viele Leute, die ins Haus kommen, die gar keine große klassische Musikvorbildung haben, manchmal gerade auf diese neuen Sachen viel mehr abfahren als vielleicht irgendeine kleine Nachtmusik, weil...
Ist ja auch überwiegend wirklich spektakulär. Ja, also Instrumente klingen anders, als sie sonst klingen. Der ganze Orchesterapparat klingt anders, als man es vielleicht erwartet. Das ist schon oft, finde ich, wirklich einfach spektakulär.
Ja, ja, und das ist dann eben, insofern kann man schon sagen, es hat immer auch ein bisschen einen moderne Kunstaspekt, insofern, weil die Schaulust dann doch auch befriedigt wird. Dann hast du es nachher, dann sitzen da hinten 12 Schlagzeuger mit irgendwelchem abstrusen Gerät und da kannst du dich einfach nicht satt sehen manchmal dran. Und das, ich finde es wahnsinnig toll, dass man die Chance hat, diese Sachen hier zu hören. Und Gilbert ist einfach ein wirklich wahnsinnig guter Sachwalter dieses Repertoires. Das kann man nicht anders sagen. Und zettelt dann eben auch an, dass er anderen Orchester, die natürlich auch viel Rundfunkorchester sind, die neuen Musikheimstätten immer gewesen in Deutschland nach dem Krieg. Und dass die kommen und dann eben auch Sachen aufs Programm setzen, was wirklich ganz pur nur dieses 21. Jahrhundert. Da kommt nichts anderes drin vor, das ist toll.
Einzelne Uraufführungen gibt es ja sogar auch, also Weltpremiere.
Ja, es gibt das Eröffnungsstück vom Alex Paxton, von diesem britischen Komponisten, der diesen Klaus-Simons-Kompositionspreis gewonnen hat. Das ist, glaube ich, für den Gilbert auch irgendwie, der hat die Partitur gesehen und hat gedacht, bah, das knallt da so richtig raus wie...
Die Noten springen aus der Partitur, hat er gesagt.
Gutes Popcorn, so stelle ich mir das vor, dass er dachte, wow, das ist echt eine wahnsinnig lebendige, vitale Musik. Und Paxton war ja auch schon hier, man hat so ein Gefühl dafür, dass er einfach wirklich... Der mag es bunt, der mag es grell, der mag es irgendwie. Und trotzdem ist es ein total sensibler, feiner Musiker.
Also. Er hat mir im Interview erzählt, in dem es um dieses Werk geht, was jetzt eben extra für das Eröffnungskonzert entsteht, hat er gesagt, beim Komponieren hat er so ein bisschen vor allem für seine innerliche Vorstellung mit zwei Buttons hantiert. Und mit einem Button konnte er sagen, dieses Orchester klingt wie ein Orchester. Und jetzt klingt das Orchester mal gar nicht wie ein Orchester, funktioniert aber wie ein Orchester.
Ist eine Versuchsanordnung, ja.
Ja, nach allem, was ich von ihm kenne, kann ich mir vorstellen, das klappt. Das Versprechen hält er. Ja, ja. Also ich bin sehr gespannt auf das.
Das ist eben auch noch so toll, ne? Du kriegst ja das Orchester einfach nochmal wieder in anderen Klangfarben, mit in anderen Schattierungen. Die Barbara Lewitsch, die künstlerische Betriebsdirektorin hier, hat erzählt, dass es ein Stück gibt, wo man wirklich einfach auf die Bühne gucken muss, weil man glaubt sonst nicht, dass das wirklich rein akustisch produzierte Klänge sind. Und das finde ich halt auch wahnsinnig aufregend. Und ich glaube, dass auch das Publikum das wahnsinnig aufregend findet. Das ist eben ein Orchester, selbst wenn es relativ konventionell besetzt ist, einfach ganz anders klingt, als man es erwarten würde und gewohnt ist.
Ich freue mich wirklich sehr auf das Festival. Vielleicht müssen wir noch kurz sagen, das Werk von Paxton, wo wir schon kurz drauf kamen, das wird mitgeschnitten und das wird es auch später dann mit Animationskunst und so ein bisschen aufwendigeren Konzertfilm geben. In der Elbphilharmonie Mediathek, allerdings erst einen Monat ungefähr nach dem Festival.
Aber auch nach Paxton sind alle diese anderen 6 Konzerte unbedingt dringendst besuchenswert.
Sowieso. Und damit viel Spaß beim Hören.
Jawohl.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Alan Gilbert, I'm really super psyched that we finally have an opportunity to have a little conversation, like a serious one, just you and I.
Very serious. It's going to be very, very serious. But I'm also very happy, and thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, and I must say, I think the first time we spoke is about 20 years ago, and that was when you were just freshly appointed NDR Gastdirigent. That must have been in the early 2000s, I think. And you were still in New York, and I think it was even pre-New York Phil, if I'm not
mistaken. It was definitely pre-New York Phil.
See,
I've had such a wonderful relationship with both the orchestra and the city. It's such a lovely, cultured place to exist, and there's a shared sense of interest. And I think that really has fed into the subject that we have before us today, the Visions Festival. You know, when you have such a long history with an orchestra, you get to the point where it's important to branch out and find new repertoire and to try to explore things that are fresh and new. Of course, the old repertoire, we can try to explore it and find new and fresh things, which is what we do all the time anyway. But this is specifically, this festival is really about trying to put our finger on the pulse of what is exciting and what is new in the world of music composition today.
I must admit, I have been reading the entire program leaflet that we have so far, and I caught myself looking for, well, where is the Rachmaninoff part, or where it's, there must be a Mozart symphony, and there's none of that. You know, it's all contemporary music, all from the 21st century, and it's super exciting, I find. I mean, we did the premiere 2 years ago, which was already great, and I think this program is even more powerful and more diverse and more branched out in many ways. We're talking about 7 concerts, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, for me, I brought the idea to Christoph Liebenzeuter a number of years ago, and the way I discussed it or described it in the first place was a kind of music world analog, or a kind of taking a page from the art world, which has well-known biennials, Art Basel, Venice Biennale, of course. And the idea I had was to try to present a snapshot, highly editorialized, necessarily leaving lots of things out, but just a selection of things that are being produced essentially now, certainly within the last 10 years, to show all in one place in Hamburg, a kind of panoramic view of different trends, different thoughts. And it's not dogmatic, I hope, in any way. It's very limited. You know, even it's as many as 7 concerts, we're limited with the number of, you know, the amount of real estate we have to occupy. But, you know, there's no dogma. There's no idea that it has to be this kind of music or from this school of composition or that. And it's quite varied, as you, I think, correctly have pointed out. And I hope it's of interest to people who are both specialists, but also who are just interested to know what's happening.
Could you imagine any other place, honestly speaking, than Elbphilharmonie who would dare such a programming?
Well, let's just put it this way. I put a similar idea into play when I was in New York, and we did a couple of editions of it in New York, and I think it was quite successful, and people were really interested in what we're doing. The tickets sold well. There were a lot of things. By a lot of measures, it was a success. And after I left, they immediately canceled the idea. They stopped doing it. So I don't know if it's because they didn't dare or they just wanted to wipe the slate clean and come up with a new artistic profile. Whatever. It happened. But they didn't continue doing it. And to have the idea, it's not the same thing, but it's essentially an outgrowth. And to be supported in this desire, more than supported, it's completely shared. I mean, Christoph took no persuading. He said, yeah, that's something we should be doing here. And you're probably right. It's, you know, the Elbphilharmonie has the platform that allows it to be daring, but it's not a given. And to be able to work with people who are actually willing to take risks. I don't think it's a big risk, actually, because I think it is of interest. You know, I'm a specialist in music, but I'm also just an everyday sort of, you know, man on the street lover of music. And I figure if something excites me, there's a good chance that it might excite other people as well.
Yeah. But still, I mean, the audacity of really putting together such a program is not something that everybody would do by themselves, you know. I think it has been traveling with you from New York to Hamburg and found a very fertile ground in this hall.
Absolutely. And I'm very grateful. And it does require a certain commitment, you know, philosophical commitment to the idea, but also a logistical commitment, because it's not easy to create a complex festival like this, and the organizations, the institutions involved, Elbphilharmonie, my orchestra, NDR, Elbphilharmonie Orchestra, everyone has to agree that it's worth, you know, giving people's time and energy and expertise to, and I'm very proud. And I feel very lucky.
And of course, it must be said that even though, I mean, the opening concert and the finale will be NDR, Elbphilharmonie Orchestra, there will be other orchestras involved, especially the radio orchestras from other German cities plus Vienna. Is it a statement, you would say, to really choose these orchestras?
Well, I mean, it's explicitly a statement, and it's a message that is implicit in any sort of collaborative project, that we actually believe that this is something that requires a joint effort to realize. And, you know, I have no illusions. This is not something we could do alone. It's not something that we should do alone. We should bring in other organizations. And of course, the IAD radio complex is a natural constellation of organizations that actually have, it took, again, no persuading to bring them on board. Everybody was immediately, yes, we would love to do that. That's also a whole nother level of complexity in arranging it, because it has to fit into the festival that we're planning in Hamburg, but somehow it has to work with their ongoing schedules. And
totally,
I'm really, really pleased that so many people have seen fit to really get behind it.
And then you don't know how often they will have the opportunity to play this very program, or will they just have, you know, rehearsed the piece and then they will use it for other
sandwich formats where they play maybe one piece that they would perform here, then combined, as I said earlier, with the Rachmaninoffs or the ordinary programming that would just have contemporary music, you know, sandwiched into.
It's an interesting question because I have, you know, if you go back in the archive of the many, many interviews I've done over the years about music and about contemporary music in particular, I'm on record. You will find quotes from me that say I am not a believer in all contemporary music concerts, that I don't feel that contemporary music should be put all into one special event, that it should be naturally and seamlessly and organically connected with the mainstream repertoire that we do every week. And I actually essentially stand behind that idea because I do think that there is the danger when you separate the contemporary music activity from the rest of what you do. It can give the mistaken impression that contemporary music is for a different group of people. And of course, it does attract a different audience, but it doesn't mean that it has to be only for that audience. And ghettoizing it, if you understand that word, of putting it to the side as if somehow it's a special kind of event that requires particular knowledge or background to appreciate. That's not the message I want to give. This is such a special opportunity to present such a wide, kaleidoscopic, wide-ranging, you know, exploratory set of events within a short span of time that I think it's worth it. I think of it a little bit like a museum where you walk through and you may be, you know, headed towards the Vermeers, or you may want to make sure that you don't miss the, you know, the water lilies of Monet, but on the way, you'll necessarily pass through, you know, the Georges Braque room or the Goya room or whatever, or the, you know, the Kandinsky or the, you know, whatever, and you notice everything. And you might stop and linger in front of one painting that captures your fancy, or you might just walk through, but it does enter your consciousness. And so the ability to be around all these pieces together, I'm sure that it gives something to people that is special.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting and very telling that you refer to the visual arts and to the paintings as we did in the beginning, you know, the Biennale of the Arts. It's so often been said that people are easy with contemporary art. You know, they go into the museums and they see all these contemporary shows and they argue about the quality, but they go. While it's in the contemporary music and orchestral music, it's so much more difficult, or it's said to be so much more difficult, because people don't intrinsically would go to these kinds of concerts. Wouldn't it be in the Elbphilharmonie, and wouldn't it be like the special format and the interesting conductors and orchestras? So why is it, in your opinion, that these art forms really don't fertilize each other in a way that is beneficial to the contemporary music?
I admire that question, and I appreciate being able to talk about that subject because I think it's so fascinating, because you hear people talk about music with different language and different kind of scope of vision, I would say. People who might be perfectly happy to look at a Duchamp toilet whatever, and consider it as art, you know, hate it or love it, but somehow respect that it is art, or a banana taped to the wall, or, you know, all these things that we know people are completely willing to go and give that a chance, not necessarily like it, but that's not the point. As you say, they will actually go and talk about it and debate it and engage in it as an art, which is what art is supposed to do. It's supposed to provoke that kind of discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And somehow with music, the same level of daring and experimental approach can more easily, I've discovered, and I think most people have seen this phenomenon, people just poo-poo it, or they don't give it, I think, the respect that it deserves. I'm not saying that you have to like everything, but I do think that you should give it the same kind of like openness of vision that you give to visual art. And I've asked myself, and I've discussed this with many people, why is this? And I don't quite understand, because it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. It doesn't make sense. People who are very open and progressive and willing to accept, you know, very avant-garde and bizarre visual art are very close, and they want to hear their music that they recognize and that sounds like a tune that they can sing or something. You know, it's like, you know, it's, you know, the all the classical virtues of painting are completely out the window when you're doing, when you see
totally.
Some of these things.
Yeah.
But that's
yeah, yeah.
that somehow it's taken seriously. And I wonder if it is connected with the element of time that music demands, because music happens in time, and the commodity of time, I think, makes you a kind of captive during the performance. And this may not be a good answer. It may not be right. It may not be complete. But there is the sense that once you're sitting in the hall, you just have to sit there. And that's demanding. And that puts pressure. In the museum, if you hate something, you can just breeze on by. And you can spend, you know, as much time or as little time as you want. You don't have that option. There's something about, I mean, art also, you know, visual art also exists in time. And that's you know, the process of walking up to a painting, seeing it from this
seeing
angle,
it from
that
different
angle.
Perspectives. Yeah,
yeah. And they people talk about architecture as art that exists in time, because as you walk through a building, you experience it in different ways. I mean, these are all aesthetic philosophical questions that I love talking about. It's very interesting. But music is really, really about time. And it's exactly what it does, is it fills up time. And the time is a very demanding element. It's a demanding medium, if you will. You know, if paint is the medium of painting, or alabaster is the medium of sculpture, whatever, time is definitely the medium. And that is something that I think people hold very precious to themselves. And if they feel that their time is being spent in a way that they're not comfortable with, I think it creates a different kind of discomfort. But I hope that people are willing in this very fast-paced world to actually let go of that kind of protective feeling of time and allow themselves to be performed to during the time that a piece lasts, and just, you know, accept it. And then they don't have to come back to hear more music of that composer if they don't like. But I imagine that if people open themselves up, they will put themselves in an even more receptive frame of mind.
But don't we do it quite cleverly by just having the concert length, the duration of the evenings? It's just rather confined to about an hour, if I'm not mistaken, and we're not necessarily having breaks in between the pieces. So
I like short concerts. I love short concerts. These concerts are not quite so short. You know, actually, the concerts will be a little, I mean, like the Deutsch, you know, oratorio that we're playing is massive. It's close to an hour long, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's really a significant piece. And the Paxton work that will precede that is looks like it's going to be about 20 minutes long. So we will do a little break, because just practically speaking, we have to bring the chorus on. I mean, I can't
rearrange the stage stuff. Yeah,
I mean, these guys are such wonderful, wonderful imaginative composers, and so distinct in the way they use sound and bring things to life. I think it'll be a fascinating program. It's pretty substantial, but the idea is also not to, like, you know, force people to just sit for hours, because I don't think it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about roughly 20 composers, a little less. Maybe we have 7 concerts, at least 2 per show. And then there are some concerts with even 3 different works of contemporary composers. And the span is really between Paxton, who was, I think, born in 1990 or so. And then we have Helmut Lachenmann, who is going to turn 90 years this fall, which is fantastic. But the majority of the composers is in their, I don't know, 40s, 50s. So kind of established, but still, you know, quite young. And then you look them up in the internet, and then you maybe haven't heard of their name ever, but then you see what they have already composed, and it's quite impressive, and all these commissions they have been given to do. And again, I mean, so many of these fantastic musicians and composers are far less known than they deserve it to be.
Well, I think that's fair to say, and the thing that I admire, well, maybe not the thing, but one thing I admire enormously about composers is the drive that pushes them to continue to write. It's not for recognition that they're writing. How could it be? Because most people would bound to be disappointed, but the fact that people have this creative, it's more than an urge, it's a need to continue creating, whether they're recognized or not, I think is so inspiring. And at the end of the day, what composers do is actually the most important thing that is happening in music at any time. Of course, it's our job as performers to try to bring it to life, but, you know, we're going to be gone. You know, we're not going to last, but somehow the music will carry on. And it was
as
very
the Latins
conscious.
Say, ars longa vita brevis. I mean,
exactly,
it's going to...
Yeah, and we very consciously have chosen many composers whom nobody has heard of. And, you know, it's we're not necessarily trying to point out masterpieces that we are sure will endure. I think we've made good choices. I think they're pieces that are worthy of being heard. But it's important on different levels to bring music to life, because everything deserves a chance. But also when other composers whose music is not being played see such an event happening, it somehow must confirm to them that what they're doing is worthy. I think it's obvious that we can't play every single piece that's written. But by showing our steadfast commitment to playing music by known composers and unknown composers, I believe that it's conscious. So it's, you know, it should be the message is transmitted that it really matters, that it's worth it. And, you know, maybe we'll find some composers. I mean, I think Dalit Warshaw, whose responses piece we're playing, I know her well. And some people who heard my Ives Fourth Symphony that I did with the Elbphilharmonic Orchestra will remember that she came and played the theremin, that crazy electronic instrument that where you move your hands
where
in the
air.
Where
you don't touch anything.
And you don't touch anything. And she's a virtuoso of the theremin, but I've known her since she was a teenager as a composer. And I think she's one of the most interesting voices. She's unknown, completely unknown.
You mention her, because I think, she's the most unknown among all these names that I found in the program. And
she's,
by the way, if I'm
me.
Not mistaken, no, of course, she's the only American, right?
I guess so. Must be.
Yeah. All the others are even Austrians or Germans or French or English or Japanese.
Yep.
How did you concoct this mixture of composers?
Well, it was a team. I mean, there are a lot of people who were involved in discussing, and we had experts in the field and people whose opinion I admire and use and respect. And we've had lots of conversations, and there's lots of input, and it's all about a mission. When you have a festival to plan like this, you know, there are literally hundreds of pieces that don't make it into the program. So you have to just put them away. And these are pieces that we have heard about that have made an impact where they've been played, or by composers that we really believe should be played if the pieces are premieres. And Paxton is a premiere, of course. He won our prize. But everyone has a track record, even if they're not so well known. Everyone has produced work that is of great interest and value, and I think it should continue to be that in Hamburg in this amazing festival that we're planning.
There's one question that comes to my mind that's maybe a little abstract, because you have said so beautifully that music is all about time, and in the moment you are performing even a Brahms symphony or something older or some, regardless what music, you are totally in the present because this is happening right now and nothing else. But I wonder, conducting contemporary music in an entire contemporary music orchestra program, does it give you a sense of being really in the now, more than maybe trying to interpret the best way you can Bruckner for the umpteenth time that you are conducting him?
Well, for me, literally every single piece that I'm doing in my two programs is a first-time performance for me and for the orchestra as well. There's no question that, I mean, and nobody has seen any of this music before. And that's both liberating in that there's no prior interpretation that we're going to be referencing or measured against. It's also challenging because there's no basis of tradition. Tradition is a useful thing. It's important. It's part of what makes an orchestra what it is, the memory of past performances of the canon of the repertoire. But as Toscanini says, tradition is also the memory of the last bad performance. So it's a mixed bag. I honestly, there's a certain complexity that most of these scores have, that the complexity means that I have just to sort of master the execution of the score takes a lot of bandwidth.
Just
realizing what's in the score occupies a lot of my energy and what I'm thinking about. But at the same time, I do try to come up with a personal point of view. I mean, I think there's no reason why you can't do a piece for the first time and have it actually be able to give it a personal interpretation, if you will. Mm-hmm. For me, interpretation is a loaded word, and we can talk, aesthetically about what that means on another occasion. But I do think you have to have an identity with anything you play, and there's no reason why you can't come to that sense of personal ownership or empathy with the score, even if it's a new piece that you've never heard or has never been performed. Information is in the score. It's possible to read a score and to understand how it's going to function. And if I've conducted hundreds of pieces, I can look at a score and have a pretty good sense of how it will sound and how it could sound.
That would have been exactly my question. How brilliant is your mind to really preconceive more or less?
It's not a question of brilliance. It's just a question of experience. That if you've done enough music, you look at a score and there are very few scores that are so different in their musical language that you have no idea what to do with it. You get a pretty good handle, and I'm talking of a wide range of possibilities of compositional styles and approaches. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why you can't learn a piece to the point that you can give a fully committed, digested interpretation. It's what study is. That's why you study a piece. It's not like you discover how it goes when you come to the first rehearsal. By that point, you've already digested it and understand, this impulse has this kind of human emotion attached to it. And the character here is going to be like this. It's not a surprise to you when you hear it for the first time because you've actually got the score. That's the thing. The score is the key to what the piece is. And so I don't think that I approach these pieces with a lower standard of interpretive demand.
Yeah, the initial question was also about the contemporaneity of yourself as a performer, of knowing, the ink isn't really dry of that piece, and it really deals with what we are dealing all right now.
I think it's different. Yeah, no, it is different when you do a piece because it's exciting, and I think that there is, of course, a certain surprise when you hear something for the first time, and it is exciting. And composers are, every single composer that I have worked with, and there have been many, they're always nervous at the first rehearsal because it's a little bit as if they're sort of revealing something about themselves that they've never shown anyone before. And, there's an element of worrying whether it's going to be okay, or if you should be ashamed or embarrassed, or if you're disappointed with how it is. And, what I said about studying the score notwithstanding, yes, you don't know exactly how it will feel or sound. And that goes even for the composer of the work. But it's, it's kind of a holy responsibility, I think, to do this. And it does, it does feel like a great responsibility, but also a privilege to be able to be part of the conception of so many works of art. I mean, most of these pieces have been played before, but it does feel as if we're doing something that is really elemental and essential to what music is about.
I think that was also part of the idea of the festival, that it shouldn't be only firsts, rather than performing pieces who have already, tested or proven that they would withstand the test of time and still be
absolutely
well performed.
Absolutely. I mean, we do our due diligence, we do our research, and we have our network of people who are aware of premieres and exciting new music that has been played around the world. And if something has made a splash, if something has really touched a chord, wherever it was played, we think, this is maybe something that's worthy. We did want to do pieces that have never been played in Hamburg. So I think not one piece has ever been played in Hamburg. That was a premise.
Brilliant. We've spoken about tradition, and I wonder to what extent you feel already like this festival is going to establish a new tradition. Maybe not only for Hamburg, maybe it could be, it's a twofold question. One part would be, could it be infectious enough for other cities who have some ambition to do something similar?
And if only. Could you, I hope so.
Or could you even imagine to double the impulse or the frequency, saying we have started as a biennale and now maybe we could even dare doing it in a yearly rhythm?
Yeah,
because there is, as you say, you had to omit so many pieces.
Yeah,
so
that's good. But I also think that being judicious about the exposure is probably a good way to go. I remember. We laughed a lot in New York when I did the very first one. We called it a biennale, the very first one. Already we called it a biennale, setting ourselves up for needing to continue. How can something be a biennale when it only has happened one time? But you understand the humor in that. But I also, we decided, okay, it seems like a reasonable frequency. It's a lot of work. Somehow it keeps it special if you don't do it every year. Of course, doing something every year could also be special. It's not that it's, but I don't know what the magic number is. You know, we also talked about a triennale, something that would happen every 3 years. It's, you know, it's, I know we've set on this pattern, and I hope that it's infectious. I hope that it catches on, you know, so that people will not be able to imagine not doing the Visions Festival. I would like it to become an institution that is absolutely set in stone, because I think it's worthy.
Absolutely.
It'd be great if we could do, you know, something every year, but, you know, maybe it's good also to have a different kind of focus. We could, you know, alternate years and have some other sort of event that maybe deserves focus as well. I don't know. I hope that every orchestra lives up to its responsibility, because I believe that all orchestras should be squarely behind the encouragement that we need to give to the next generation of composers. I think that is part of our mission, not only to play music, but to deal with the idea of composition in a way that takes it seriously and gives it the respect it deserves. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the tools that I'm employing to try to live up to that mission. And I think that most organizations are not doing enough and are afraid of what they consider to be, you know, unnecessary risks. It's a short game, though, if you're only playing pieces that people already recognize, because it doesn't feed the artistic life of the organization in the same way if you're not pushing the boundaries of the repertoire. And it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say, well, people are not going to come because it's not interesting enough, then the lack of belief comes across. Mm-hmm. It's an unmistakable message, even if it's not explicitly stated. And then people will not be as interested. I firmly believe, again, not all music is for everybody. I've spoken to people who don't like Beethoven, if you can believe that. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, you know, whatever. And so it's not that everyone has to like every composer, but I firmly believe that even someone who says that they only want to hear Beethoven and Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and Dvorak and Mozart will be able to appreciate those composers more the more music they know of different styles and genres and periods, because it feeds your receptive skills to hear more. You see Monet with different eyes after you've seen Picasso. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, the visual analogs I use, because as you pointed out, is something that people somehow accept and they understand implicitly. But I think the same thing goes for music.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Alan, my last question for you would be, will you have enough time to really savor all the other concerts, or at least a good portion of those concerts that you're not being conducting and not the NDR at Philharmonie Orchestra will be involved?
I can say with complete honesty and complete sincerity that I wish I could go to every single concert. And I promise that I will go to as many as I can. It's a difficult schedule for me as a conductor, because the scores are, as I said, all new and complicated. And it is, frankly, exhausting to rehearse pieces like this, because it requires a special kind of concentration, focus, because, you know, if you don't, it's not as familiar. So I can also promise that I won't be at every concert, because I'm sure that's the reality, but I truly wish I could be, because I think it's, you know, that would be the best way to experience this is to, you know, I don't know if there's simultaneous concerts that make it literally impossible to be at everything.
No, it's all.
But to be able to hear every single thing, that would be an experience I would dream of being able to savor.
Yeah. So we're all very much looking forward to this Visions Volume 2 festival, and I'm grateful that you took the time to tell me a bit about your ideas behind it and your joy that goes with it, really.
This has been one of the most enjoyable interviews I've done in a long time, and I thank you for that. No, truly. I do a lot of these, and you know, it's like you never know what's going to be asked, but to be able to talk about the kind of aesthetics and the philosophy behind it, that's something that really that gives me great pleasure. So thank you for that.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.